Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, July 20th, completes the first 6 months of Donald Trump's presidency of the United States. The time that has passed since his inauguration, January 20th, seems so many multiple eons longer than the 48 years since human beings first stepped foot on a world other than Earth on this date. Two American astronauts rode an eagle to the moon on July 20th, 1969. 10 years later, when gas shortages made it difficult to get home from work, a paper eagle popped out of a 3-year crypt and declared itself reborn. Today, July 20th, 2017, is the posthumously 38th birthday of the then revived North Coast Times Eagle, aka the born-again bird. 10 years to the day, one of the space travelers described the moon as a magnificent desolation. The resurrected paper eagle reawakened into a desolate world of its own. Instead of lifeless, it swarmed with billions of busy, ambitious creatures, though at least half were starving or underfed. Millions more were killing each other or planned to. A few impoverished the many. The planet was despoiled for short-term profit and pleasure. Truth, as usual, was a first casualty. The North Coast Times Eagle was born again in radical defiance of reason and propriety because, as it proclaimed in its first editorial, First Amendment newspapers have become as rare as the nation's symbol, the bald eagle. The independent press has virtually disappeared into the huge corporations that control the country and probably the world. Like everything else, the role of the press is in question. There should be no doubt. The press should have no special interest than the First Amendment, which is patently impossible when the press is controlled by corporations whose interests are often in conflict with the Constitution. As this first editorial suggested those many years ago, it seemed naive and quaint to produce a small, impoverished newspaper at a time when vast political, military, corporate systems imprint their impressive agendas upon billions. After nearly 30 years of improvident existence following its resurrection from the crypt, the born-again bird succumbed a second time, most likely final time. Its life was bicameral like the human brain and the modern calendar, divided into the early 5-year era of the old bird and the reemergent born-again bird raised from a 3-year crypt, yet afflicted with various smaller deaths and resurrections, nearly all of its remaining 3 decades of poverty publishing. The resurgent Times Eagle had a raffish Dickensian sort of life, stops and starts, rashes of publishing followed by aridity, generally due to a frequent inability to pay for printing. In that regard, this small, improvident newspaper mirrored a few earlier generations of independent newspaper publishing. Its contributors were most often its readers, and it sought to display or publish the works of artists, poets, and writers who live on the Oregon coast and inland. It was a polemic laden with doom and gloom, a newspaper that some people thought necessary, but did not always regard with rapture. In commemoration of the born-again bird's Renaissance Day today, July 20th, I wish to present a heartfelt ode to the underappreciated poverty press, of which it was a robust and true blue partisan for nearly 30 years until digital challenges triggered its second trip to the crypt. Micromedia Mouse, and I wrote this. Start with a quote by Nelson Mandela. A free press is the foundation of liberty. Followed by another quote by George Orwell. If liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. From the first moment of his presidency, Donald Trump declared the mainstream media in America as the enemy of the people, and never misses a tweet to call it fake news. A compulsive liar who seems to think truth is only that which benefits and adulates him, Trump considers the First Amendment a permissive and unnecessary impediment to be ignored and ultimately abolished, despite its being the bedrock of American freedom of thought and speech. In normal times, the mainstream media has problems not only with veracity, but its own frames of censorship, primarily due to profit and politics. But Trump's declaration of war upon the First Amendment has caused an alliance between America's variant mainstream media as well as with its traditional opposition media, both left and right wing, although Trump has his alt-media supporters of the Rush Limbaugh ilk. Although nearly everybody claims to love the idea of freedom of thought, speech, and performance, most feel uncomfortable with freedoms they do not endorse, generally regarding them as sources of moral, economic, or patriotic decline of the nation. What might be described as the independent advocacy media operates in the usual climate of verbal and political civil war between those who would enlarge freedoms of speech, thought, and action, and those who would restrict them. This unfettered media is a hodgepodge of a few small presses and public radio stations, as well as internet blogs obsessed with visions unaffected by commerce. And don't forget free speech TV. They are descended from radical newspapers and magazines that blossomed briefly a few decades ago, and their lineage threads back to the prickly press that fostered the First Amendment, which denies government or anyone else the right to interfere with freedom of speech. The independent advocacy media has few pretensions toward objectivity and fewer illusions about its probability. Most small independent journals and broadcasters are chronically understaffed, underfunded, and generally misunderstood because they seldom reflect popular opinion. They act, often myopically and insensitively, as consciences and torchbearers, and most are fierce and shrill advocates for large or esoteric causes. They are usually on hard times and fail more often than they are replaced. A common trait among peripheral media is to either revive from a few deaths or succumb forever. Small, impoverished, out-on-the-fringe media generally dwell in local obscurity. They are often in stormy opposition to the bland or autocratic community rule and standards of their circulation areas. The fringe is most normally their habitat. They defy the momentum toward the mega-big as they incubate ideas or ideologies that captivate or hold them captive. Radically inclined, usually malnourished, hogtied by its own paradox, independent media's vows of poverty dovetail with probability and implicitly limit financial contact with ideologically incorrect sources of revenue that spread the diseased creed of consumer consumption. Through mainstream media, small potatoes newspapers, magazines, radio stations, and probably a few insolvent internet media take their begging bowls out on the streets like hungry monks, or organize parties with music, poetry, food, and liquids, and pass the hat among fans, sympathizers, and rubberneckers who come through the door. It is this obsession with the principle that all human beings are free and equal that keeps the majority of the poverty press struggling on. In particular, our national freedoms seem to be only wishful lies, bedtime stories told us by those we apparently select to lock our minds in chains to avoid responsibility. Nearly everyone is fearful of the dangerous, uncertain period we are struggling to live through. No one seems to know what to do, and the simplest answers are probably wrong. Fear shows concern and masquerades as apathy. Truth becomes event translated into entertainment. Small independent media that seldom make money are large on seeking answers and truths. Though never quite satisfyingly pure, truth must yet in the real world be free of deceit and distortion. It must be like a rock or a star, a fact defined by its existence. A cornerstone of the American Revolution and its subsequent Constitution was that not only would Americans be independent as a newly formed nation, but that each person was a citizen of a republic, which reflected the concern of the founders that both aristocracy and the masses provoked separate but equal problems. A free and unconstrained press was recognized as essential, and for more than a century, American journalism was robust, if partisan. Until 20th century journalism moved away from political feuding to promoting a corporate industrial status quo under the rubric of objectivity. The press itself became a huge corporate conglomerate of print, radio, television, and internet, now called the media, uppercase. the contrary press was relegated to the fringes and has generally acted as the mouthpiece for radical and esoteric political causes. It is called the alternative media, lowercase. Persistent efforts by government and powerful elites to dominate and manipulate public dialogue, particularly in matters of political dogma and social behavior, have always been dangerous and usually the guise for arbitrary usurpation of the apparatus of communication. Realization of this led directly to the Constitution's First Amendment, which is only 228 years old in 2017. The First Amendment states clearly and simply that neither government nor anybody else has the right to deny or interfere with freedoms of speech, press, or religion, or with public gatherings. It is unequivocal. Nothing shall abridge freedom of speech, therefore freedom of thought. It is our distinguishing ideal, unfortunately, more in theory than actuality. The continuity of a culture of so-called radical journalism is essential, which journalism schools seem to be breeding out of recent generations of young journalists in a quest for centrist or objective principles of news and commentary. It is crucial for widely divergent views of everything have public conduits, and the very edgy on the fringe media is just about all that persists against the pervasive conformatization of American media and society. The paradox, of course, is that fringe media is readily dismissed as not only being outside of mainstream centrist conformity, but also that it preaches to the fringe. And the great masses of Americans, of whom less than half generally vote, seldom read, watch, or listen to heretic or apostate media. Yet the choir must be kept up with fluxions of music as medical people, the light speed changes in medicine. When what is considered a mainstream source of information becomes increasingly similar to Goebbels speak, Fox News TV, for example, the fringe media has to pick up the slack of the quickly disintegrating First Amendment. Although it might seem absurd to print newspapers in an era when print media is supposed to be dying as a result of the digitalization of media, it is in perilous uncertain times as now that independent publications are most necessary. Printed independent papers or magazines such as Astoria's Hip Fish, as well as public broadcast media like KMUN-FM, must keep popping up because they are not simply fringe agitprop, but are more cogently the recurrent incubation of American journalism. And the more castrated and concentrated the mainstream media becomes, with or without Trump's vile influence, a painful and insipid form of oblivion, the more necessary for small, self-reliant, non-centralized publications and media to flower. It is not only necessary to speak truth to power, but also to egregious consumption and waste, to apathy and avarice. Truth must also speak to conscience, as well as to humanity's pernicious penchant for slaughtering itself and despoiling the planet it lives on. William Allen White wrote in a Pulitzer Prize-winning essay, "You say that freedom of utterance is not for times of stress, and I reply with the sad truth that only in times of stress is freedom of utterance in danger. No one questions it in calm days because it is not needed, and the reverse is true also. Only when free utterance is suppressed is it needed, and when it is most needed, it is most vital to justice. This state is in more danger from suppression than from violence. Violence, indeed, is the child of suppression." Newspapers like the Times-Eagle reflect the dismal and deadening. Yet through dark funnels, history is understood. Each era is a funhouse mirror of every other, and each adds to a vastly accumulating weight of an unstoppable lunge toward catastrophe. These next few years promise to be vivid and intense for unrepentantly irreverent independent media. "In a dark time, the eye begins to see," Theodore Rothke wrote, which flew on every flag of the Times-Eagle. Mouses must roar after all and bite at the ankles of ponderous tyrannies if any of us are to keep our heads and humor. Micromedia, flamboyant, irreverent, raffish, and raggedy patched up like an old inner tube, marches into the third millennium. And that was something I wrote, Micromedia Mouse. And I sort of picked from a lot of other things I have written to form the whole of this one. And now, again, something I wrote, The Sound of Guns. We which is more or less inspired by the last article that I just read. Exactly 50 years ago this month, in late July 1967, I think I wrote the most immediately necessary story of any I ever wrote for a newspaper. Ironically, it was for a military newspaper. After a year in Vietnam as a USMC combat correspondent, I spent 6 months in Japan as editor of the Iwakuni Marine Corps Air Wing-based newspaper, Toryteller. I wrote the story, actually more precisely an editorial, in late July 1967, as I said earlier. I apparently made a few precedents in military journalism with this story and broke several taboos, declaring what official military policy endeavored to deny, that racial strife was growing throughout the American armed forces. The background of the story is that white and black Marines on the Iwakuni base were swiftly moving to imitate race riots that had taken place the previous two summers in the States, beginning with Watts in 1965. Already in the summer of 1967, huge riots in Detroit and Newark had broken out, and American military bases all over the world were tense. It seemed as though the Marines at Iwakuni were about to light their own fuse. I frequented both white and black off-base bars to talk with both sides of the dispute, fortunately given reprieve in the black bars as a result of several black Marines I had been in Vietnam with and who trusted my intentions. I was particularly struck with the sense of inevitability among the Marines that a riot between the races would break out, and so I wrote my screed. And this is it. The sound of guns. Their fierce staccato dominated the background as the news broadcaster described the action. You can hear the sounds of automatic weapons. There's a profusion of them here. They are returning fire against snipers, trying to clear them out. Vietnam? Unfortunately, no. Newark, New Jersey. Another race riot in a sweltering, bloody tradition of riots, leaving its dead behind like scattered cigar butts. The 3 years the riot-torn summers have filled the newspapers and subsequently the worried minds of millions of confused Americans of every race. Judgment of these riots with all their reasons, their passions, conditions, bloodshed and destruction, and unanswered questions must be left to the conscience of humanity, individually and collectively, and to history. What concerns us here is the immediate effect they have on the armed forces, both black and white alike, who must live and work together, and in the extreme instance of Vietnam, must fight and possibly die together. Ironically, they fight together for what they have been told is for the freedom of someone else, and yet they cannot escape the reality of strife amongst their races at home. The civil rights movement somewhat parallels the situation in Vietnam. You cannot force people to change their minds. However, in this particular instance, wrongs demand their redress. We as a nation are waging war in Vietnam because our leaders say it must be done for that reason. We cannot then expect otherwise, however right or wrong, from those within our society who have been wronged. If the military might be the only demonstrative proof of equality among the races, then use this unique position you are in to show the people back home it can be done. For God's sakes, do not regard one another as enemies. As you look upon one another, embarrassed and wary, perhaps angry and suspicious, because of these recent riots at home, do not forget for an instant that you are all Americans, that to these people in Japan and other countries, you are nothing else. I have questioned you throughout the base and in the town of Iwakuni, where you have lamentably segregated yourselves into two districts, one black, one white, and you are ready to blow the lid off because you think it's inevitable. Can't you understand you are making it inevitable by believing it's inevitable, waiting for that one spark to set you at each other's throats? I am not concerned here in this article with the rights and wrongs of your beliefs or prejudices. I am pleading with you to cool it because I don't want to see you tearing up a third people's real estate. The Japanese have had to put up with enough from us already without getting clobbered on the periphery of a racial struggle 5,000 miles away. Face it, who will be hurt the most if you let this thing explode here? You or the Japanese sucked into the cyclone? You know damn well it will be the Japanese. Is it right for a third race to suffer because some hardheads from two others can't get along? Some of you do not like the Japanese, but admit it, those of you who do not generally don't like anybody other than yourselves and those who are most like you, whether you are black or white. That's what bigotry is all about. Look around you, in your barracks, in the hangars, on the flight line, and maybe you'll discover the truth of the old saw that no argument is truly black or white. Look around you, and you will see, for the first time, that you are also Japanese American, you are Chinese American, Mexican American, American Indian. My God, the stew of you is infinite, and some of the roots are here in this land. Think about that before you cross the line that can only lead to your own self-destruction and the destruction of everything you hold dear. And that is, as they say in journalism, a 30 to that article. My concern about the consequences of a race riot was a result of having been at Watts in 1965, the year before I went to Vietnam. I was a reporter for a Pasadena newspaper before reenlisting in the USMC for what I considered the war of my generation. Watts was my prelude to the war. The fires, the killings of blacks by police, considerably more than the official body count, in the same manner we blasted and burned Vietnamese in their villages. It seemed like half the black Marines I knew in Vietnam were Watts survivors, given a choice between jail and the war. A day or two after the Tory Teller issue with my screed went to press, I was ordered to immediately leave Japan for stateside. I later learned the Iwakuni Air Base commander, a colonel who had been a World War II fighter pilot and continued his wartime prejudice against Japanese people, blamed me for not being promoted to general as a result of my editorial and other articles I wrote. I blatantly disobeyed his orders to not have the editorial published, conspiring instead with the Japanese printer, who happily and risked his contract with the USMC. Many people came to sit with me on the airstrip as I waited for an airplane to Okinawa and a CONUS-bound ship. Marines of both races who said I did the right thing and perhaps prevented a riot from occurring, which many more gave me credit for in letters to me later when it did not occur, young service brats from the base, an American foreign exchange student attending the local high school, a smattering of Japanese friends and other Iwakuni residents who supported my article. A few of the young, both Japanese and American, sang peace songs accompanied to a couple of guitars. I did not wish to leave Japan. My ambition had been to return to Vietnam as a civilian reporter with a Japanese newspaper, the Asahi Sun, and counter the war propaganda churned out by the American press, both military and civilian. Stateside, I got a job with Associated Press after my honorable discharge from the USMC, but was fired for writing about anti-war dissidents. The same happened in New York when I worked for NBC, the Today Show. But I was a founding member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War and helped organize chapters of Vietnam vets all over the country, often attacked and jailed by cops and National Guards. And now, a poem honoring today's anniversary of the Moonshot by Arthur Honeyman, which he titled Moonshot. And he wrote a day later. Yesterday went beyond history, and I watched it while my mind couldn't fathom or accept or believe what my eyes saw. Everything seemed, looked like a stage, a science fiction stage, as a camera swung round and visited the miles of barren flatlands and the hills peaking in the distance and transmitted each image 240,000 miles to my eye receptors. Then came the spacesuits with voices from inside. Men they were supposed to be, men that I couldn't grasp or see, bouncing, floating like a robot. But really, they say, it was 1/6 gravity. Yesterday's event, my left-wing friends will say, were a waste of money, for man is too small to take care of Earth, never mind littering or garbaging or cluttering the rest of the universe, or even a piece of it, much as they might be right. I'm all for space travel. But already I see man carrying his ego beyond the world. Yesterday he drove his prejudicial American flag into the soil, claiming peace and territory at the same time. Already he carries his colonial ambitions beyond the Earth's atmosphere in the spirit of Columbus or Admiral Byrd or modern-day presidents claiming for the United States its democratic, imperialistic idiosyncrasies. I'm all for space travel. I think it could be the salvation of man. Our world of overpopulation may force us to move on or destroy ourselves. But I pray to some God with some vague hope that there is such a God that yesterday's primitive performance of erecting American flags or Russian flags or Andorran flags symbolizing possession is never repeated again. But knowing man, knowing the U.S., it will be, and man will garbage the universe. Yesterday went beyond history, but man stayed primitive man. Yesterday, I don't believe what I saw, that man stood and walked on the moon, that he stood there and borrowed, probably forever, from the once awesome, silent sea of tranquility. And that was Arthur Honeyman, Moonshot, which he wrote on July 21st, 1969. And one of Arthur's oldest friends, Michael Marsh, described him as a moon-bitten fool in a poem he wrote, "The Tiger is Drunk Tonight." Spittle and carnage, red death in your beard, the confined coughing laughter, and always unnatural movement, the jagged arm, clawing hand, pointed at all and random. Note, in guilt, their eyes seek even mirrors for relief. The world is not safe from the moon-bitten fool. Would that we were all moon-bitten fools. Both are dead now, their lunatic spirits